Hello and welcome. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar today, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. For thousands of years, we humans have been fascinated and even inspired by birds. Native cultures lived amongst them and used them for divination and rituals and even mimicked their calls and songs and their language. Of course, poets and novelists and painters have attempted to capture their beauty, and people spend hundreds of dollars a year trying to attract them into their backyards, or maybe even thousands traveling around the world to watch them. They've helped so many in the human endeavors, everything from learning to fly to providing us with food and clothing and helping us understand the human brain and body. But our guest today, veteran environmentalist and journalist, New York Times writer Jim Robbins, says one of the most important things that birds do is they remind us of our deep and abiding emotional connection to nature. In his new book, The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future, Robbins notes that a shared wonder about the miraculous nature of birds may be the best possible strategy to reshape the relationship that we have, not just with these creatures, but with the earth and amongst ourselves. Jim Robbins is a veteran journalist. He's based in Helena, Montana. He's written for the New York Times, for Condé Nast Traveler, and other publications, and he's the author of 6 books, including The Man Who Planted Trees, and of course his most recent, The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About the World, Ourselves, and a Better Future. It is so good to have you on the show, Jim Robbins. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Good morning.
I was reading some of the reviews of the book, and one of my favorite authors, Rita Mae Brown, wrote, "It's one for the birds. What a wonderful book. It will give you wings." And it really, really did. You know, I guess because we are surrounded by birds all the time, it's so easy to just take them for granted, and you certainly have not. Your book is a real revelation. So you've written other books about nature and the environment. As I mentioned, The Man Who Planted Trees. You've written A Symphony in the Brain, The Evolution of the New Brain. So of all the species and naturally occurring phenomenon in the world, what led you to write about birds?
Well, there are a lot of books about birds out there. They're a charismatic animal, and people love them. That's no secret. There's over 50 million birders in the United States. But what I wanted to do was kind of talk about how people interpret birds. I call this book An Interpretation of Birds, and how we can interpret them to tell us more about the world. The first chapter is about a scientist, for example, who studies bird flight in X-ray machines and in high wind tunnels, and to understand bird physiology. And then he has used his understanding of the physiology to figure out how the first dinosaurs might have flown. That's an interpretation of birds. And it turns out we do a lot of that kind of interpretation. We look at bird brains and their singing to tell us something about how humans sing and how humans speak, and look at the brains of birds because they learn to speak and sing just as we do, in the same very similar way. So you can tell a lot about human speech that you can't look at in humans, and a lot of researchers do that. We can interpret birds to tell us something about murmurations, and those are those big flocks of thousands or tens of thousands of birds that move as one. There's some great videos on YouTube. You can Google murmuration and see some of the beautiful flight that birds do in unison, and that's a great mystery. No one knows how birds do that without banging into each other and colliding, and it's being investigated by a number of scientists to interpret something about our world. But one of the themes there, and one of the themes of all my books, is how much we don't know, what a great mystery the world still is, and to think we've figured it out is well beyond what we know, and there's lots to learn, and I think hopefully to encourage, these books will encourage some humility about how little we really know about this world around us.
And about ourselves, for that matter. I think what really drew me in the most is how you describe what these creatures can tell us about ourselves. You say, if you want to know how Machiavellian power relationships among humans evolved, just look to the deceptions and alliances that take place within a flock of ravens. Tell me about that.
That's right. There's a researcher in Vienna, the University of Austria there, who's studying ravens and how they form alliances and how they groom their allies and how they battle with each other as a way of understanding how that same behavior amongst humans shaped the human brain. And I'd never heard of Machiavellian politics amongst ravens, but it turns out it's an area of study also amongst some mammal species like the great apes and so on. So it's this dynamic of humans jockeying for power. And it turns out ravens have a very similar kind of style of earning the best nest sites and the best food sources and so on. Another one of my favorite things along those lines is the fellow from the Cornell Lab, top premier bird institution in the world, that studies white-fronted bee eaters in Africa. He studied that for 20 years to understand these are birds that live in a family relation, extended family relationship. So it's aunts and uncles and brothers and sisters all live together, and they all are helpers at the nest, as they're called, and they all help raise the new brood when seasons are dry and the food sources are low. But then when rains come and things are good, then these helpers at the nest will take off and form their own families. And he thinks that this is how humans evolved, the same kind of style, you know, thousands of years ago. So he studies family relationships and the evolution of family relationships and what that means to relations between step-parents and their step-children, or between grandmothers and their children. And he's become a big advocate for such things as granny flats, building apartments for the grandmother or the mother above the garage, because he believes that this research shows a lot about extended family relationships and how important they are across the course of evolution.
Who could have imagined that studying white-fronted bee eaters in the desert cliffs of Kenya, studying these birds would lead to things like, in real life, making sure that extended families stay together. Did any of that surprise you, or were you kind of on the trail of that kind of information about birds before you started?
No, all of it surprised me. I mean, I'm an environmental writer, and I wrote a couple of, I mean, I've always loved birds, and I've written a couple of articles recently about birds, but as I kind of investigated this, I went, wow, this is amazing, a true wonder. I've never heard of a lot of these things. Secondly, I was surprised a lot of this isn't out there. That's one of the things that drove me, is there's a lot of information about birds that is absolutely fascinating and off the charts, and it hasn't been widely disseminated. And I think that is one of my goals here, is to say, look, folks, you know, wave my hands. There's a lot more going on in the natural world than we realize, and even more, I think, than we have collected with all of our sciences. One of the chapters is about something called ethno-ornithology, which is the study of how indigenous people relate to birds. And birds are central to thousands of cultures around the world. And because they're charismatic, because they're food, because they sometimes are human, or are bird relatives to these people. But there's something very different about indigenous people and how they perceive birds. And so this field, ethno-ornithology, seeks to study these relationships, to tell us something about the natural world outside of our own culture. And I think that's really important. I think if there's one important chapter in this book, that is probably the most important one, because it says there's many different ways of seeing the world, and we need to investigate and understand and how we do that. And I think a lot of our problem has to do with how we perceive the world, and ethno-ornithology tells us something about that.
I imagine there are a lot of bird watchers. The Bay Area is full of regional parks and national natural preserves, and I have a hunch that there are some bird watchers listening. So if you're a bird watcher, if you have questions about birds, tell us what your favorite bird is. Give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're talking to Jim Robbins, the author of The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About Ourselves, the World, and a Better Future. We look forward to hearing from you. But I'm wondering how we began studying. You said, I know you did 2 years of research, and you indicated that it's been studied for hundreds of years, but it goes back as far as certainly at least Leonardo da Vinci. There are drawings showing that he studied birds in order to try to come up with a flying machine, right?
That's right. He did hundreds of drawings and sketches of birds, and he really, a lot of the things he realized and wrote about birds were very much ahead of the time. I write in the book that, you know, at the time he was in the 1500s when he was doing his work, people thought that didn't know birds migrated, and they thought that they turned to stone. Some people did, and turned to stone and dropped to the bottom of lakes in the wintertime. That was one of the beliefs. And it wasn't until the 1800s, I think, or 1700s, that people started to realize that, that there was something else going on. I think it was in the 1800s when someone in Germany found a stork from Africa with a with an African spear through its neck, and it realized it had flown from Africa to Germany, and that's where it came from. People had no way of telling where these birds went, so that was a great mystery. But back in the 1500s, Da Vinci hypothesized that they flew south and that they migrated. And so he came up with a lot of ideas about birds, how they fly, how the air moves around them, how the air behaves like a fluid when it comes to birds, and all stuff that really wasn't known until much, much later. So he really was on the cutting edge of understanding how birds fly.
And also there has been a great deal of study, perhaps more recently, about how the intellect of birds. I mean, of course, there's, you know, when someone calls you a bird brain, you might think that that is an insult, but your research has found that it is anything but. Can you just talk about bird intellect?
The last 10 or 15 years has been a great revolution in how people think about bird intellect. The bird brain is very different looking than the mammal brain. And so there's always been an assumption since over 100 years that the bird brain is inferior to the human brain. And in the, I think it was 2005 or 2009, there was a consortium of scientists who said, look, the bird brain is different than the mammal brain, but it's not inferior. In fact, birds may be the second most intelligent animal on the planet after humans. And
wow, that includes simians?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And they renamed the parts of the bird brain to reflect the fact that the birds were much smarter than they first thought. And then there's also a whole school of assessment of bird brains that looks at the brain and a lot of the microarchitecture of the brain, the things that govern hearing and seeing and so on, is almost identical in some ways. So the brain looks different from a whole, you know, holistic point of view. The various parts are very much like a human brain, and almost surprisingly so. So there's a lot of scientists have revolutionized how we think about birds and the bird brain and what that means. I mentioned that, for example, that bird speech or bird song is learned in a very similar way to human speech, and also the parts of the brain are very similar.
One of my favorite old stories is Aesop's fable about the bird that was trying to get a morsel of food, and it floated the meat to the top. And you have you surmise that it might actually be based in fact, that there's a New Caledonian bird. It's called a New Caledonian, right, from New Zealand. And somehow this bird seems to understand fluid dynamics. and was able to use a cork to go down to the bottom of the water and bring up the food. Can you talk about that experiment?
The New Caledonian crow is probably the smartest bird, or depends on how you measure intelligence and what is included in intelligence, but many people think it's the most intelligent bird. And it's found off this remote island off the coast of Indonesia, or is it New Zealand? Anyway, in the Pacific, South Pacific. And it's remote, and they captured some crows, and they took them to the lab, and they realized that these crows are able to use tools. That's one of the hallmarks of intelligence for an animal species, is tool use. Chimpanzees do it, gorillas, or even some other species that use tools in a very crude way, but New Caledonian crows use tools, understand something called meta tool use. But what they do is they have a direct tool use in which they drop pebbles into a water. And this is in a laboratory experiment. They put a piece of meat on a cork, and it's down inside of a tube floating, and the crow knows enough to grab a certain kind of pebbles that will cause the cork to rise as it drops these pebbles into the beaker. And that's a hallmark of intelligence. The other thing that they've done, they put two of these New Caledonian crows in a cage. Abel and Betty are their names. And they put two pieces of wire in there, one straight and one hook, to see if they could use it to grab pieces of meat. And when Abel got in there, he grabbed the hooked wire right away and raised a bucket of meat and ate it. Betty didn't have a chance to respond right away, and she grabbed the straight piece of wire and bent it immediately into a hook and did the same thing. So that is a whole other level of intelligence in which an animal grabs a novel material and immediately makes it into a tool. Which really, people were just flabbergasted, experts in this, watching this filmed experiment with Betty the Crow raising this bucket of pig heart, which is a favorite food.
In fact, that particular exercise implies the equivalent intelligence of a seven-year-old human, a seven-year-old child.
Right. And then the other thing that these crows have done is something called meta-tool use, which I mentioned, which is that they'll take a hook, and they'll put it in a cage, and they'll lock it, and you need a stick to unlock it, and they'll put that stick in another cage, and then they'll do a third cage. And so this crow will go into the first cage, grab the stick, open the second cage, grab that stick, which will unlock the third one, take out the third wire in the third cage, and use that to fetch food. That's called meta-tool use, and that is also, it places birds at a much higher level of intellect than we previously thought. And as one researcher told me, they think three chess moves ahead. And so what it seems like our understanding of bird intellect is only limited by our ability to imagine the right kind of experiments to show how smart they are. And we may be in for a lot of learning in the future because we haven't designed enough experiments yet to demonstrate that intelligence.
And especially crows, because they seem to be so common that we just probably just overlook them and look for maybe something that looks a bit more exotic or that isn't quite so common. But they are so intelligent that one of the researchers called them like flying monkeys with the equivalence of a simian or maybe even more than a simian brain, right?
That's right, and you said they're common, and of course there's lots of birds that are common, ravens and pigeons and so on. So what my goal is with this book is when we walk out of our doors and we walk down the street or down the alley, that we see these birds, we kind of, instead of just ignoring them, especially pigeons because they're everywhere in urban areas, that we stop and we say, wow, there's a lot more going on here than I thought, and that there is a true wonder here. Pigeons, for example, in the cities, they have been trained to search for sailors shipwrecked at sea. They used to put them in a cockpit underneath the plane, and they would fly around the ocean looking for bright orange life vests. Pigeons are much smarter and able to discriminate between a Monet and a Picasso
Wait a minute. Did you say, I'm sorry. Was that hyperbole or
no,
are we
no,
supposed to take that?
That was an experiment.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
did that work? That I need to hear about.
Well, I don't know. I just mentioned the study in passing. Again, Google it.
Yeah.
And but it's a well-known fact that pigeons are very smart. They perform better on some tests than children do, human children. So they're very smart. And when you see them flying up onto a ledge in an urban area, there's a lot more going on than you know. Some people think that pigeons are really important because they are, for a lot of urban dwellers around the world, they are the last contact with birds in the urban areas that we have. And they may be are linked to supporting and protecting biodiversity because of their charismatic role in cities. So it's called the pigeon paradox, and also that's something you can find online. But it's... it's interesting.
I'll say it is. There's certainly a difference, of course, between ravens and crows. But scientists are pretty impressed with ravens, too. One of the members of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says, with other animals, you can usually throw out about 90% of the stories you hear about them as exaggerations. But with ravens, it is just the opposite. What do they mean by that as relates to ravens?
It means the stories are so far out that, you can't dismiss them. And I'll tell you one story that I read an ornithologist wrote in a paper. It's mentioned in the book. I spend a lot of time in Yellowstone Park, and I live not too far from there, and I write about it for the Times and other publications quite a bit. And ravens are known as wolf birds. They have evolved with wolves, and so I've seen a lot of ravens in Yellowstone Park flying with the wolves. In fact, the most ravens ever seen on a elk kill are in Yellowstone Park, sharing the bounty with wolves. But they're also predators themselves. They're not just scavengers. And the far-out story that I read was that 140-some eared grebes landed on Yellowstone Lake and didn't realize that it was frozen. It's a big lake in the center of the park. And they couldn't take off because it was so slippery. And four or five ravens saw what was going on. They went out to the center of the ice, and they killed every single one of these grebes and stashed cached the food all around the lake. In a matter of hours, they had destroyed this whole flock of grebes. I mean, that's quite an extreme predation story for any bird. Mm. But ravens are just a fierce predator in some ways.
I've always wondered why they call it a murder of crows. Where did that come from?
I don't know. Someone got creative with bird names. There's a Parliament of Owls, and there's a Murmuration of Birds. So someone is inspired. I don't know much about that, why that name is there, but someone was inspired by birds to give them all of these different names, these poetic names out there, probably because of the transcendent nature and the charismatic nature of birds.
Ah, just one of those things that keeps you looking up more and more about birds. So, what are your favorite birds, and are you a bird watcher? What questions do you have for Jim Robbins? We hope you'll stay with us. There is a lot more to learn about the wonder of birds, and we're going to look into it when we come back. Stay with us. Thanks for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up next. Speaking of which, tomorrow we talk to a group of children and young adults who have sued the Trump administration for its failure to address climate change. It's a fascinating story, and we'll be talking to them and to their attorney about the success and where they are in that lawsuit. So Hope you'll join us tomorrow. Today, we're talking with veteran environmental journalist and New York Times writer Jim Robbins about his new book, The Wonder of Birds, what they tell us about the world, ourselves, and a better future. Let's go to a call. Hi, Robert in Richmond. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much, and I really am enjoying Mr. Robbins' information. So, as a large tree outside my condominium window that is filled with what I refer to as crows, I don't really know the distinction between crows and ravens, but there are also a number of families there, and I wondered, are crows monogamous? Do the guys stick around, or are they, you know, runaway dads or whatever?
Great questions. Thanks, Robert.
Well, I don't know if crows are monogamous, to tell you the truth. Birds are a lot less monogamous than they thought. They used to think species, and part of this is in the book, like bluebirds, were faithful pair bonds. And what they found when they started doing DNA work is that they weren't faithful at all. They were sneaking out at night and so on, and there was lots of DNA swapping going on. So birds are a lot less monogamous than they used to think, and it took a long time for ornithologists to accept that. It wasn't welcome news in the field.
And he also mentioned that he wasn't sure if what he had in his backyard were crows or ravens. I don't know if you've heard of iNaturalist. It was founded a few years ago by an online community of biologists at UC Berkeley, and they would basically, you can point your iPhone, your camera phone, at a bird or any species, and it'll pull up exactly what it is. So instead of just, oh, this is a small brown bird, and you don't even know how to begin to Google it, the picture immediately picks it up and tells you. Have you heard about that particular app?
I have, and there are other apps. Cornell has one, the Cornell Lab, where you put in where you are, the size, the species, and the size, the color, and where you saw it, and it gives you four or five pictures to pick from if you can't get close enough for a photo to tell you what that bird might be. And the difference between a raven and a crow is found in the tail. A raven tail is a crow tail is fan-shaped, and the raven tail is more tapered at the end. That's something you can easily identify, tell the difference between a crow and a raven. Both very smart, both corvids, member of the corvid family, and both probably at the top of the smartest birds in the world list.
And, you know, given how the rest of different species have evolved, dinosaurs, birds are just dinosaurs that happened to make it through the evolutionary process. How did they manage to make it through, although there are some differences? I mean, you've got pelicans who are designed in one way and hummingbirds that are designed in a completely different way. How did they make it through the evolutionary trials?
Probably the fact that they could fly and they could move to distant areas, whether there was a volcano going off or some threat over the years, they were highly mobile. And so they could survive in far-flung places. There's a story about an island called Surtsey in the book, which is off the coast of Iceland. And it rose, I think in the 60s, it rose out of the ocean, part of a volcanic eruption. And it was barren rock. And within several decades, birds flew to this island, brought with them eggs and grass and seeds. And within 30 or 40 years, life, largely because of the birds, had colonized this island. And so birds are what's called mobile resource linkers. They can travel far to far-flung places, bring life with them, and change the health of an ecosystem because of the fact that they have such ability to recolonize an area with new life forms.
All right, let's go to another call. Esme in San Francisco, thanks for joining us.
Hi. I have some raven stories. I work in cemeteries, and every cemetery, anyone will tell you, is filled with ravens. And I have a story about one of the funeral directors who was working late at night, and she was afraid of the ravens. and this gang, and they were acting like a gang of three huge ravens, put a pebble in the door and then tapped on the door and like harassing her. And then when she tried, it freaked her out so much, and when she tried to get out, because of the way they put the pebbles in the door, she couldn't open the door. And that's just one story. But they went to every single funeral, and they would either sit on the roof of the mausoleum screaming at the top of their lungs as people came in, or in some services they'd be in the trees whispering, and they whisper like this little whispering noise. And every funeral was different, but they went to every funeral. In both these are two different cemeteries I worked in Northern California, and they absolutely fascinate me.
Thank you, Esme. That's a great story. Maybe that's where Edgar Allan Poe got the idea. Does that surprise you at all, Jim Robbins?
No, it doesn't. And actually, there's someone I met, a biologist, who's studying crow funerals. They believe that crows hold funerals for their dead, bring them pieces of grass and so on, gather around them. I think there's even some videos of that on the web. One of the interesting things about ravens that I learned also in Yellowstone is that people there, they take snowmobiles in, and they pack up their food and other things in these compartments on the snowmobile, and ravens have learned how to undo bungee cords and get into these compartments and get food, get car keys. There's a poster that the Park Service puts up warning people that ravens will get into your compartment and take your keys, your food, your wallet, and you need to make sure that you watch it at all times when you're stopped, because the ravens are able to figure all this out. So there's a lot more going on there than we've been able to divine.
So precocious, I imagine. But they wouldn't make very good pets, I'll bet. Is there any way to domesticate them?
There are people who have raised them from nestlings, but that's beyond my understanding.
Okay, let's go next to Amy. Thanks for being with us. You have a question about hummingbirds.
Yes, I actually have a couple very quick questions. One is, I've heard that crows can recognize people's faces, so I was wondering if hummingbirds can also. I know I'm one of many people who put out hummingbird feeders and have a lot around my house, and so I was wondering if they can recognize us as individuals and form relationships with those of us who they see putting out the food. And then one other quick question. A couple years ago, I was a few miles from my house and had a rather bad experience. Somebody had a meltdown in public and was yelling at people. And very strangely, in a place that didn't seem like a park, a hummingbird came and kind of hovered right outside my car window, my driver's, while I was sitting there calming down before driving away. Could that have been a bird from my neighborhood?
Interesting questions. Thanks, Amy. Jim, you have a thought?
Well, I'm not sure that it's been studied in hummingbirds whether or not they can remember faces like crows can. And that's well established that crows can remember faces, in fact, for a long time. There's been work at the University of Washington with people with masks on. And apparently they can also teach other crows, members of their murder, as it were, about the dangerous masks that researchers wore during some of the things they did to crows. But I don't think that's ever been studied in hummingbirds. And I missed the second question, the last part of the second question.
Is it possible that a hummingbird would have the kind of flight distance, that it could have hovered right by her car and recognized her and followed her to another destination?
Well, again, I don't know about the recognition part of it. I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. But hummingbirds, are, as far as flight, I mean, here are calliope hummingbirds weigh about the same as two paper clips. That's how light they are. Their bones are filled with air. Their feathers are really light. And every year they fly from the state of Washington and Oregon. They fly all the way to the Gulf of Mexico, into Mexico. So they have this migration. They fly through raindrops, they fly through wind, they fly through snow, and they make it. And researchers, hummingbird researchers I've talked to, have no clue how they do it. So again, there's I'm convinced that the natural world is far more full of mysteries than it is of things we know. And so whether or not they can fly, I wouldn't be, with her car and recognizing her, I wouldn't be surprised.
Wow. Great questions. If you have a question, this is the guy to call, Jim Robbins, the author of The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About Ourselves, the World, and a Better Future. What are your favorite birds? Are you a bird watcher? What questions do you have? Give us a call, 866-798-8255, or you can send us an email at yourcall@kalw.org. So, Jim, let's talk about the flock. You have a chapter on the extraordinary design of the flock. And, you know, I don't know, in every inspirational team-building exercise I've ever been in, you know, they use that example of the flock where the front goose creates the leadership and the uplift of the other birds keeps everyone aloft, and there are all kinds of lessons to be learned from those birds in a V formation. Is any of that true, or all of it true?
I think all of it's true, as far as I know. One of the great migrations of geese, they fly in a flock formation, is over the Himalaya Mountains, and it's the highest migration of any bird. It's above Mount Everest, so it's above 24,000 feet. They've seen these bar-headed geese making this migration from India to Tibet, and they've been studied by experts, by biologists, to understand how it is that they're able to function and fly in a day over this very thin oxygen atmosphere, through this very thin oxygen atmosphere, and survive. What is it about their physiology that can enable these birds to make this trip? And what they found is that the bird has a whole suite of adaptations. It has bigger lungs, it has more red blood cells, it has it breathes, it has a capacity to breathe the air and then breathe it again. It has bigger wings and more loft, and so all of these things, this bird has adapted to this extreme a migration over millions of years by creating all of these ways to survive and thrive, really, in this very difficult environment with wind and cold and so on, 30 below, 40 below zero, and things like that. And some people think that this bird may have started making this migration more than 70 million years ago, and it simply continued as the Himalaya Mountains rose. And it just got higher and higher and higher over these millions of years, and it was able to form all these adaptations through the process of evolution during this time. At the other end of the world, there is the penguin, which can dive down to 1,600 feet. Humans go down to about 130 feet. So what is it? What are the adaptations that emperor penguins have that allows them to go to depths that humans can't come anywhere close to? So researchers are also studying penguins to understand how these birds can go down so deep to levels that would crush and kill a human being, and swim around down there and look for fish to catch.
If only we could do what they show us how to do, right? Once again, one of my favorite things is the seven things that geese in formation can teach us. By flying in a V formation, the whole flock achieves a 70% greater flying range than if each one flew alone. And by flying in that formation, they have better visibility. And when one drops out of formation, two others go down to accompany it. And they switch out the leader so that no one leader is more exhausted, and they share that responsibility. They honk to encourage each other and to keep recognizing each other. It's just extraordinary to me. And, you know, ever since I read that, I've never looked at a flock of geese the same again. And that's kind of what you're aiming for, isn't it? For people never to just look at a bird or a flock and take that for granted.
So much, yes, that's right. And so much of what we, of how we are in the world, of how we treat the world, is about perception. I think perhaps more than anything else, I'm trying to change people's perception of the natural world to say there's true wonder here, there's true mystery here, there's a lot more going on than we know. And to have respect and humility for it, to say maybe we shouldn't destroy habitat for these birds because there's so much of these creatures have evolved for over 100 million years. 100 million years, it's deep time. And these birds have every year, every generation have made improvements slowly, and just like the bar-headed geese, and to think that we just, in a blink of an eye, can wipe a species out, which we have, is, to me, insanity. Famous naturalist Louis Agassiz said that every species is another idea in the mind of God, and I don't mean it in a religious sense, but more in a spiritual sense. Who are we to say that these species that have evolved over millions of years from the time of the dinosaurs should disappear? I think that's what I'm looking to say, is that this is wonder. This is possibly a spiritual thing, and I think people should pay attention to that and consider that. You mentioned a flock. I wanted to just say, I think one of the more interesting aspects of the book is something called metacognition. That in large flocks of birds, like the disappeared passenger pigeon, researchers believe that these birds got together and had a kind of a supermind, that it was they were much smarter as a group than they were individually. And he believes, he's at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, and it was at Princeton for a long time, studying something called swarm intelligence. And animals in a swarm or a herd have a much greater intelligence than animals alone. And they get together and they vote, essentially. They say, we should migrate this way. We should eat here. No, there's better food here. When should we migrate? Which way should we go? Those are the kind of things that are high risk. Migrations are especially high risk. And when birds get together, they form a supermind that allows them to make better decisions. And I think this is one of the things, again, it's so humbling to know that birds have this super intelligence, and there are people trying to recreate this intelligence among human beings and to understand it so that we might do some problem solving with climate change and so on to create a kind of supermind among human beings.
Fascinating. All right, let's go to our next caller. That's Kathleen in San Francisco. Hi, thanks for holding on, Kathleen.
Thank you. I went to a bird rescue center over in the East Bay, Sulphur Creek, and there was a woman who spoke one day. She has a corvid rescue place over past the East Bay. And so one story she said was amazing to me. She said she raises these rescued babies and releases them. And one day when she was walking around a reservoir over in the East Bay, it was a corvid. I don't remember if it was a crow or a raven, was talking to her, which she didn't find unusual. She, of course, loves them. But what she said was that it changed its voice to a more baby voice, so she would know who it was. Hmm. Is that possible?
Jim,
again, I would say almost anything is possible, because it simply is how little we know about birds. There's a researcher from McGill, Louis Lefebvre, who went through all of the ornithological literature about bird behavior and about feeding, because that's where the most intelligence is displayed in birds, because it's about their survival. To look at all of the different notes that ornithologists take about observed feeding behavior, he looked at hundreds of species. One of the things he found was that there are vultures in South Africa who were observed sitting on a fence post near a minefield. It was during one of the wars there, Civil War, and they would wait there for gazelles to come through and trigger the mine, and when the gazelle was blown up, they wouldn't have to spend their energy tearing the animal apart. They could just feed on the pieces because it was already prepared, essentially, for them. So I think the stories and the anecdotes about birds are almost unlimited, and I wouldn't be surprised if any kind of story like that is not true. I mean, it's so little, again, is known about all these different behaviors.
Okay, we have several folks who want to ask you questions, Jim. Let's go to Desmond in Berkeley. Hi, Desmond.
Hello. I have a son who lives in Japan, and he has a Japanese jungle crow. It's 4 years old. And for the last 2 or 3 years, he's talked about moving his family back to the United States. But the obstacle has always been the crow. He won't come back without the jungle crow. It's a part of his family. And the concern is the COVID virus. In my primitive way of looking at it, you should be able to just sort of check for that particular bird for the virus and put it through quarantine and bring it back with you. But he's, according to what he's telling me, that isn't possible. So I just wondered if you had any advice that you could pass on that might help him on that.
Jim, you have a story. I'm sorry, what's the name of the bird? Desmond? Okay, Desmond's gone. But you do have a story in the book about how birds were used mistakenly in Africa in hopes of wiping out a hemorrhagic fever because they were eating the insects that were thought to carry the disease, only to find out that the birds themselves were actually carrying the disease. So birds as carriers is not unusual, right? Jim, are you there? Okay, we're going to take a break and come right back with Jim Robbins. Thanks for coming on back with us. We're talking to Jim Robbins. Hi, Jim, are you there?
I am. I don't know what happened there. Sorry about that.
Ah, cell phones. What are you going to do? But, you know, Desmond had an interesting question about being able to import a bird. I think he said his son is in Japan. But I was talking about a part of your book where you talked about scientists mistakenly hoping that birds could help wipe out a hemorrhagic fever because they were eating the insects that carried the fever. But it turns out that the birds themselves were carriers. So there are instances where birds themselves carry pathogens, yes?
That's right. West Nile virus, they've spread that around. They also use birds as indicators for West Nile virus. They capture birds in places and they look for the disease. So it's kind of a sentinel. One of the things we haven't talked about is how birds are sentinels for a number of things.
Let's talk about that, by all means. Birds as sentinels.
Right. Miners used to take birds down into the mines with them in little cages, and when the methane levels got so high that the bird dropped off its perch, they would then leave the mine because it meant that it was dangerous for them as well. And someone even came up with a cage that once the bird dropped off the perch, they would have a little oxygen cylinder attached to the cage and would turn the oxygen on so the bird didn't die and they could use it again. Birds are sentinels for a lot of things. What's happening in the world, there's a program called eBird that the Cornell Lab has pioneered, in which it uses bird watchers all over the world to tell them what they're seeing and where. And they put it all into a great big high-speed computer, and they have these incredible maps of where birds are and where they're traveling, with something that's never been available before. So they're using bird watchers as biological sensors all over the world. And so they can tell if birds are disappearing in one place, that means there's something going on. There's logging or something like that being done that's destroying habitat. And so, or it might be disease amongst birds. And so birds can tell us a lot about the world and ourselves in this way.
They're quite literally canaries in the coal mine. I think we have time for one more quick question. Elizabeth in San Leandro, it's you.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. My question is about the crows. They've recently come into San Leandro and kind of taken over, and I noticed that I think most of my favorite local bird populations are completely devastated. Do you have any reason of why the crows are moving in? And thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, there's been news stories about that, Jim. So with about a minute and a half left, can you opine on whether they're running other species out?
Well, there are a lot of changes taking place because there's changes in habitat from climate change. I don't know about this specific instance, but it probably has something to do with food source. I know there have been changes in food along the coast based on warm currents coming up from the Gulf and so on. But I honestly don't know without looking into it. I'm more of a general expert, not an expert on specific areas.
It is one of the best reads I've had this year. It's called The Wonder of Birds, What They Tell Us About Ourselves, the World, and a Better Future. Jim Robbins, it was just a great read, and it was great having you here. Thank you so much. There are about 30 seconds left. Anything you want to add before we say goodbye?
The most important thing you can do if you're concerned about birds is find ways to help protect and restore habitat, whether it's in your yard or in the wilderness area or anywhere. Birds need places to live.
Thank you, Jim Robbins. It would be a good one to put on your Christmas book gift list, The Wonder of Birds by Jim Robbins. Thanks so much for being here. Sorry we couldn't get to all of your calls. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at yourcall@kalw.org. Malihe Razazan produced today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. And Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Renee Kemp in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.